Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Ahead, we'll talk with an historian and author of a new book on Abraham Lincoln. It focuses more on the women who shaped his life and legacy. Loving Lincoln, that interview is ahead. Also, with the world focused on Donald Trump's tariffs, we'll visit with a professor and supply chain expert to find out what it all means for consumers. And the floral industry could be impacted by tariffs. The bulk of the cut flowers in the U.S. come from other countries. Can we grow enough here to keep up with demand? Changes at the Federal Library Department could weigh on your local library and the services offered. Also, hate crimes have been on the rise in Illinois. Legislation being considered aims to combat some of those incidents. We'll have those stories and more for you coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Thanks for being with us this week. First up, a professor at SIU Carbondale, who's an expert on the supply chain, says while President Trump's broad-based tariffs on imports to the U.S. have clearly had an unsettling effect on global stock markets, it could also create some underlying effects on supply chain management. Brad Palmer talked with the SIU Carbondale Assistant Professor of Operations Management, Greg DeYoung.
Just like the markets really don't like uncertainty, businesses don't like uncertainty either. And so it's really tough to know where your products are going to come from when you're trying to find a good source at a good price when you don't know what the price is going to be because tariffs are bouncing around like this. So it's a real issue for businesses as well because most of the businesses are running internationally. Now we're in a global economy. And so they're sourcing materials globally. They're selling their products globally. And this really adds a really strong level of uncertainty about both supply and demand for businesses. And so it's just a problem that has to be navigated. And unfortunately, it is volatile. And so that makes it especially hard to navigate, not knowing what's going to happen. The market doesn't mind bad news if it knows it's coming, and the market doesn't mind good news if it knows it's coming, but both can be really disruptive. Same thing for businesses. Good news and bad news are okay as long as you know they're coming.
Talking about what President Trump has alluded to, hoping some of these tariffs lead to further negotiations on trade with other countries, is that something businesses in the supply chain would be supportive of in trying to negotiate some new deals?
Well, certainly if you're a U.S. manufacturer and you're facing high tariffs in a lot of countries, which is the case for, Japan has fairly high tariffs. China has some pretty high tariffs in places. Agriculturally, Canada has some very high dairy tariffs that, you know, frankly, we would like to see go away if we're a U.S. dairy farmer. So from that standpoint, lowering global tariffs would certainly open up some markets to the U.S. that just really are not feasible right now. Because of the tariff, protective tariffs, and countries will use tariffs to protect their own industries. They don't want to lose their jobs, so they just keep the tariffs high and keep the jobs at home because the domestically produced products are a little cheaper. So there definitely is some room across the globe for lowering of tariffs, and to some extent, maybe even the U.S. has some tariffs that are a little bit protective as well. And so from a global trade standpoint, we'd love to see all the tariffs at zero because then we could have things produced at the most efficient places. They could be sold everywhere. And really globally, the consumers would all be better off, but there would certainly be some local pain and some very heavy political pain to be paid out of something like that. And that, so that's really what this is trying to kickstart, I think, is moving us to a much lower tariff overall because that would be beneficial to everybody, even though it's going to cause some definite rearranging of things. And whether or not we can get there, that's a political question for not just the U.S., but really around the world.
Are there any other potential winners out of this scenario than who you just alluded to?
Well, I think the biggest potential, especially for our area, would be the farm community, because the ag products are traditionally one of the things that countries like to protect with their tariffs. So if you go to Europe, there are a lot of farmers who are in business because they have some very high tariffs on U.S. products that keep the U.S. products out. And, you know, people like to see the farms. We like to have the farms. We don't want to be dependent upon the rest of the world for all of our food. And Europe and other parts of the world are the same way. They don't want to lose their domestic food production, even if it's very inefficient. Because in a time of crisis, you're going to want those things. So there are some very high tariffs on U.S. agricultural products around the world. And certainly from a farm perspective, that would be to the benefit, our benefit to open up those markets to get lower tariffs and more access to those markets for U.S.-based farmers who are particularly efficient in many different products in many different ways. So I think that's really the biggest potential winners out of this if things work out. At the same time, they're the first line that's going to get hit, and they're going to be the first losers in all of this too, because we are in such a global market for commodities. If China raises its taxes or its tariffs, essentially, on U.S. agricultural products, that's going to come right back to the farmers, and they're going to see that price at the elevator the next day. And so they're probably suffering first, but long term, they seem to have probably the most to benefit in a lot of different ways too.
What are some of the other losers potentially here? You talk about offshore producers of some particular products that could be on the losing end here.
Well, certainly if you look at apparel, part of the problem with apparel is it's very heavily produced overseas, Vietnam, China, places like that. And it is very much a price-sensitive market. So if you're looking at clothing, other than some very specialty things, when the newest Nike shoes drop, people are going to buy those regardless. But buying tennis shoes day in and day out, we're pretty price-sensitive about those things. And so if you are an importer of those type of products, you stand to have some real problems if your plants are located in a high-tariff country. And then you have to decide, do I keep producing there and take the hit of the tariffs, or am I going to move my manufacturing, which is really, really difficult. So I think a lot of those manufacturers that are importing to the U.S. are having difficulty. From the U.S. exporting to China right now, which is probably the biggest tariff combatant that we have going on, you see a lot of, again, agricultural products, food products, some high-tech products, a lot of equipment and such. So if you've got large customers in China, you have to decide now, am I going to be able to sell to them effectively, or am I going to lose out to competition because of the tariffs?
How could the supply chain be impacted? There's talk because of the tariff war, so to speak, going on, especially between China and the U.S. right now. There could be a slower flow of products going from China to the U.S., vice versa. How could that impact the supply chain?
Well, it's going to affect the container prices, for example. So if we really see a drop in exports from China to the U.S., you're going to see a real decrease in the cost of containers, because most of those containers are being used to carry products on that route. And if they're not used, there's going to be a lot of excess capacity. At the same time, you're going to see things like domestically, if we're producing more domestically with domestic raw materials, you're going to see higher prices for rail and truck transportation in the U.S. because they're going to have more work to do. They have to produce the products. They have to bring the raw materials to the factory. Then they have to take the raw materials that are converted into products and ship those back out to domestic customers. So there will be an increase in traffic on the domestic routes to some extent. And that could actually result in the raising of prices because we just only have so much capacity there. So it's really going to be a reshifting of things. Again, you know, three or four work days into the tariffs, nothing has really changed as far as where people are sourcing their products from yet. But if this goes on for weeks or months, you're going to start to see those supply chains rebalance as well. And there's going to be some that get cheaper, and you'll see lower prices for those modes. You'll see higher prices for other modes because we don't have a lot of excess capacity in the supply chain transportation world, especially.
Is the supply chain still reeling somewhat from the pandemic, or has it recovered for the most part, or where do we stand as far as that goes?
Well, we certainly are. You know, we've been through kind of like 5 years of pretty serious supply chain shocks, whether it was obviously the pandemic, but also more recently we had the West Coast port strike, then we had an East Coast port strike. We've got the Houthi situation really bottling up the Suez Canal. We've had just, you know, continual challenges for the supply chain, which to some extent that's good because it's like we're exercising, we're getting stronger, we're a little more resilient. We certainly understand the importance of having a resilient supply chain with some redundant capabilities and such. At the same time, there's not a lot of excess capacity. So to some extent, the supply chain is necessarily fragile because we just can't afford the excess capacity we would need to make it really, really robust. So we're just kind of, we're bouncing from one problem to the next, it seems like. And, you know, for the most part, I think we're dealing with them pretty well more recently. And so in terms of this one, you know, again, supply chain people are really, you know, if they're not looking forward, they really need to be. And this was not something that you couldn't at least foresee as a possibility. President Trump has been talking about tariffs long before he was ever elected or inaugurated this time. He was talking about implementing tariffs last time he was in office. So it's not something that you could have said, wow, I never saw that coming. It clearly was on the table. I think maybe the extent and the willingness to really go out and justify the tariffs has maybe caught some people by surprise. It's going to be volatile, so you'll better buckle your seatbelts, but it's going to be a bumpy ride for a while, but hopefully it works out to a better place.
How would you suggest consumers deal with all of this?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to not get caught up in the hype. It's easy to see things like this and say, wow, the market is going crazy, so I probably better panic too. But you have to realize, again, that the market, especially the stock markets, that's they're emotion-driven entities. And so I think from our standpoint, taking a little longer-term perspective on things, understanding that if the tariffs raise or lower, that doesn't mean products are or aren't going to flow into the country. That just means that the price might change to some extent. It certainly is a good idea to be aware of where your products are coming from. Maybe not the luxuries, but the necessities of life. So if you've got pharmaceuticals and food, things like that, you should know where they're coming from. You should kind of understand the supply chain already and understand that, well, if one third of our pharmaceuticals are imported, if the main supply for this particular drug is coming from China, I need to be prepared that the price could go up on me. And so I need to understand that. At the same time, again, this is not the kind of, if the stock market is too volatile for you right now, then we need to pull some money out and put it somewhere else. And the same thing goes with the rest of our life. So if you can't sleep at night, it's a good time to look into some of those things and make some changes. But you don't want to overreact.
SIU Carbondale Assistant Professor of Operations Management and Supply Chain Expert Greg DeYoung. He spoke with Brad Palmer. Tariffs are a new thorn in the floral industry's side. In the U.S., the bulk of cut flowers making their way into shops are foreign grown. The Trump administration tariffs mean local florists might have to pivot to homegrown alternatives. But some Midwest flower farmers say it will be a challenge to meet the demand. From St. Louis Public Radio, Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson has that story.
Walking up the gravel road through the iron gates of Queen Bee Bloom's flower farm, you're instantly hit with the intoxicating smell of fresh flowers.
I can smell it already.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I'm going to make you put on glasses the way I see things. We're going to stop right here. How's that sound?
That's the Queen Bee herself. Lily, we're walking through her 164-acre Spanish Lake floral paradise. It's filled with all sorts of goodies, including viburnum, pink dogwood, and cherry blossoms. Lily is on a mission to get more people to see the value in flowers native to the U.S.
I'm probably one of the luckiest flower farmers.
In February, her farm was approved for a grant through a USDA program that would have allowed her to extend her growing season and install a well.
I mean, I had a couple hours of just elation. And then the next morning, the news was that all the funding was being clawed back.
The federal government struck again when the Trump administration's first wave of tariffs put the floral industry in an economic bind. She says meeting the demand for local florists will be a challenge for farmers without that federal support to expand.
You can't have it both ways. You can't try to drive business back to this country while not helping us be ready for it.
Roughly 80% of cut flowers sold in the U.S., including heavy hitters like roses and tulips, are imported from places like Ecuador, the Netherlands, and Colombia.
It's kind of a wait-and-see kind of moment, which is maddening for the flower farmer because everything we do is a year in advance.
That's Mima Davis, co-owner of Urban Buds. It's an urban flower farm in St. Louis. She's currently harvesting ranunculus for the Tower Grove Farmers Market.
Now is my time to place my order for next season, but I have no idea what the market is gonna do.
Davis has been in the flower farming game for 30 years, and right now, she and her crew are trying to navigate a new level of uncertainty. Thinking about what the tariffs will mean long-term weighs on her.
It would mean cutting back, becoming smaller. I'm already a small farm, how small can I be?
The tariffs are heightening a decades-long problem in the industry, dating back to the 90s. The U.S. promoted flower growing in South American countries to boost the economy as an alternative to drugs. Tariffs were then eliminated from their cut flowers. Davis says that shuttered mom-and-pop glass greenhouses in the U.S.
Because all of a sudden, Ecuador was shipping roses, chrysanthemums, all kinds of crops, flooding the market at a very cheap price.
Wholesalers are already telling florists they might need to eat the extra cost or pass it on to their customers. That's something local florist Amari Basua wants to avoid.
One way I'm doing that is by trying to utilize local growers. We have several in the St. Louis area, thankfully, who grow really unique things.
The good news is she already gets some of her stash from Urban Buds. The owner of Noon Moon Bloom Co. in Edwardsville says, as a small black-owned business, the tariffs are a hard pill to swallow.
Because we do already have contracts and things planned out for our future. So I think initially it was a little bit of worry, like, what am I going to do in this situation? How is that going to affect us?
As the tariff war wages on, flower farmers say the best thing people can do is take advantage of the flowers that are native to and seasonally available in the U.S., as well as support their local growers. I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson, St. Louis Public Radio.
Federal prosecutors are changing their tune about a big financial penalty for the convicted former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan. Dave McKinney reports.
Madigan was convicted in part of conspiring to accept bribes from Commonwealth Edison as the utility pushed an aggressive legislative agenda in Springfield. Beyond possible prison time, Madigan faced more than $3 million in financial penalties that the feds attributed to his wrongdoing. But now, prosecutors no longer are seeking that seven-figure forfeiture. In a new court filing, they say their about-face is attributable to, quote, a matter of discretion. The feds also are arguing against a Madigan request for a new trial, saying his demand is ill-founded. Madigan's scheduled to be sentenced June 13th. Dave McKinney, WBEZ News.
A different perspective on Abraham Lincoln. That's just ahead on Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. A forthcoming book from SIU Press is titled Loving Lincoln, A Personal History of the Women Who Shaped Lincoln's Life and Legacy. It's by Charleston historian Stacy Lynn, who is a former assistant director at the Papers of Abraham Lincoln and a current editor of the Jane Addams Papers Project. She's interviewed by her friend and our reporter, Maureen McKinney.
You've written books, including the biography of Mary Lincoln, but this book is different. You've taken an entirely new approach where you're fusing your own life with the Lincolns and your experience with grief.
It wouldn't have occurred to me until very recently. There's some things that you discover in your life as time goes by and you wake up one day and you realize this is the story that I want to tell. So in 2016, 2 years after my daughter died, I lost my job at the Lincoln Papers. And it was like a grief on top of grief. And then Hillary Clinton lost the presidency that same fall. And I was feeling just so overwhelmed by my life sort of had fallen apart. I started writing as kind of a remedy. And I wrote this 130-page screed about Lincoln and passionate politics and how we've lost that in modern America. And it made me feel better, but it wasn't, you know, anything that could possibly have been published. A couple more bad years in my life, and I finally started to kind of come out of my fog of grief in 2018 and kind of started all over again. And then the pandemic happened. And I had a great deal to sit around and think about during the pandemic. And I kept coming back to Lincoln. I kept coming back to the stories of the women in Lincoln's life that I had collected over the years. And there was such solace in in being with Lincoln again, and in the trauma of losing my job at the Lincoln Papers, I kind of was finding myself back to Lincoln. And he was not only a solace for me, but also a motivator. And I remembered an acquisition editor at SIU Press had told me years ago to call her first when I was ready to write my book about Lincoln. And I did, I called her. And the book that was written, it kind of just magically happened, Maureen, honestly. I sat down to write a collective biography of all these women, these stories of women's mothers and sisters and friends, of Mary Lincoln, of the women who Lincoln helped in his law practice, and the women who came to see Lincoln when he was president, asking him to help them with their sorrows, to get a loved one back from a battlefield, or to help them find a job in the government. And the book that I wrote ended up being this kind of collection of essays about women. And what I realized after I wrote it is that I was one of the women. And so there were these five essays about the women who shaped Lincoln's legacy, like Ida Tarbell and Mary Lincoln, who had him buried at Oak Ridge, and Sally Field, who played his wife in the movie Lincoln. And there was Stacy Lynn, too, as a woman who had been a Lincoln scholar for 30 years and who also had found great inspiration in the life of Lincoln. So what I ended up writing kind of happened by accident. And it was this kind of beautiful, weird, crazy, cool kind of an approach to Lincoln. So it kind of blurs the lines of biography and also memoir. And I think the result is this collection of stories of all of these women who loved Lincoln into being, and the women like me who continue to be inspired by him today.
You've experienced great loss in your life. Did your experience with grief inform how you looked at the Lincolns?
Yes, it really did. One of the things that we are taught when we're trained to be historians, we're trained to have distance from the past, to treat the past like it's a foreign country, to treat people who lived before us as somehow other, and to maintain an objective distance. And what I increasingly found over the course of my career is that my enthusiasm for history and my empathy and my kind of love for the historical characters that I studied was losing something in translation, because I was like stiff-arming my kind of relationship to these people. And by writing this book, what I discovered is that my grief in losing my daughter was not really different at all from the grief that the Lincolns felt when they lost their first baby, Eddie, and then, of course, the devastating loss of Willie right in the middle of the Civil War. And when you read Mary Lincoln's letters about grief, I mean, it sounds like me. I mean, it sounds so much like my experience. And what I learned is that shared humanity, that connection that I had to the Lincolns was even deeper than it had been before. And I think I understood them better as a result of giving in to that. But I also, by the time I finished reading this book, what I realized is that I want people to not only read this history that I've written, but also to feel it. Because I do think we are connected to the people of the past. And if we have empathy for the past, then it matters more. And we can also, I think, if we have empathy for the past, if we can connect and relate to the people who lived before us, then maybe history can be more useful in the modern context. And I argue in this book that some of our human characteristics, our love, our loss, our grief, our experiences are not so different.
In the book, you talk a lot about older male scholars not being always particularly welcoming. What has being a woman scholar of Lincoln meant?
It was difficult to be a woman in Lincoln Studies. It's a male-dominated profession. Every year, there are new books written about Lincoln, and very rarely are they written by women. They're almost all written by white men of a certain age. I was always chafing against this paradigm in Lincoln Studies that Mary Lincoln was horrible, that she was crazy, that she was this great man's greatest mistake, that while Lincoln's melancholy fueled his greatness, Mary Lincoln's mental frailty at times, her emotionalism, her feminine passion, was considered nuts. And so I always chafed at that, and it put me in a position to always kind of be on the defensive in Lincoln Studies. So the other thing that it did is it made me afraid to write a biography of Lincoln, to tackle a Lincoln book, because I was told over and over again that by the actions and the comments of people within Lincoln Studies, that I had nothing to say. If I was going to defend Mary Lincoln, what possibly could I say? And when I started writing this book, and when these stories of these women started flowing out of me, I realized that it had been an armor to focus on the periphery of the Lincoln story, to write a biography about his wife, to write articles and to study, when I was editing his papers, to study the women in his law practice. I did it to kind of protect myself. And what it ended up giving me was a different voice. That in writing this book, now I'm really proud and happy that that's the way it has turned out, because it has made my story here in Loving Lincoln a unique story, a different gaze. Some troubled waters in my time in Lincoln Studies. I don't regret any of it, because it brought me here to this book and these stories, and telling it with my own female gaze, which I think is valid and appropriate and in some ways empowering.
Tell me some of the stories of the women you've included in the book, some of your favorites.
Oh gosh, that's so hard, because there are snippets of stories, large, you know, they run in different, you know, some of them are more detailed than others. There's about 90 women whose stories I tell in the book. So picking a couple of favorites is hard. But one that I will talk about is this woman named Susanna Weathers. She was an old widow living in Indiana when the Civil War broke out, and she made her president a pair of socks. And she wrote this letter, and she sent it off to Washington with her socks. And Lincoln got the socks, and he loved the socks, and he wrote her a letter that I think is one of the most beautiful letters in all of Lincoln's correspondence. He just writes this letter of gratitude and respect and common connection with this woman who was from Kentucky and had made these socks in a way that he recalled, you know, from his own mother's making of socks. And it's just this beautiful, compassionate, heartfelt letter. And her story, this is a humble gift, a pair of socks, but it meant everything to her to help, you know, her president and his poor cold feet. But also too, it's reflective of Lincoln acknowledging this woman who had done this kindness for him on a day in the life of an American president who's worried about a nation at war. I just think it speaks to Lincoln's political ethos, and it's definitely one of my favorite stories. Another favorite story is a woman by the name of Susan Duggar, who was a young woman in Southern Illinois. She lived in Carlinville, and when the war broke out, her brother went to war, and she was living with an aunt and uncle, and she decided, she heard somehow that women could get jobs in Washington, D.C. So she goes to Washington, D.C., and she gets a meeting with Lincoln, and he helps her get a job in the Treasury Department, Because during the Civil War, Lincoln put a lot of women, maybe as many as like 450, 500 women to work in the federal government. And this young woman became one of those workers. And she went on to have like a 40-year career in the Treasury Department of the United States. So I love that story too, because it helps, it gives a sense of Lincoln here helping this young woman get a job in 1861. And then in 1912, when she's retiring, she still has this letter that Lincoln had written that referred her to somebody in the Treasury Department for a job. And so that story, connecting not only to Lincoln, but this young woman becoming a professional woman as a part of a group of women who are going to work during the war, is another one of my favorites.
Tell me a little bit of how your read of Mary Lincoln differs so much from a lot of your colleagues.
I think my understanding of Mary is born of a deep knowledge of her life story that a lot of historians who are writing Lincoln biographies are less interested in delving into. And so one of the things that I credit to Mary that I think sets her apart in a lot of ways, and I think it's one of the things that made her so attractive to Abraham Lincoln, is this really unusual education that she had. So she had 10 years of formal, what counted as formal education for a woman, at a time when, you know, most girls, I mean, if they had a couple of years of school, they were probably pretty lucky. And a lot of women still, even at this time, were illiterate. And here's Mary Lincoln, who grew up in a wealthy household that believed in women's education. And so she had all this education. She had a father who encouraged her to have opinions and then to share her opinions. And then she goes to Springfield, and that's who she is when she gets to Springfield. And I think Lincoln gravitated towards her because of that. There was something about her intellect and her spirit that appealed to him. And the other thing that I think sets me apart is that I see the Lincoln marriage as kind of in the middle of kind of an old-fashioned Victorian marriage and a modern kind of a marriage where, you know, there's really quality between partners. The Lincolns were in some ways very traditional, and that's fine. Mary Lincoln was not a feminist at all. She had no interest in those kinds of things. She saw her life in a domestic kind of a context, where I think Lincoln biographers want to just see her, okay, this is an old fashioned, this is the 19th century. She's supposed to be the little woman being good and whatever at home. And Mary Lincoln is kind of caught in between. And I, not only do I give her credit for having her opinions and having confidence in her voice, even after she goes to Washington, she involves herself in politics wherever she can, because she's obsessed, like her husband, with partisan politics. And she's interested, and she's a patriot, and she wants to be involved. But also, too, that she's not Elizabeth Cady Stanton advocating for equal rights. So she kind of sits in this middle and that's nuance that Lincoln biographers don't have time to give the female characters. And one of the things that I argue in my book, Loving Lincoln, is that as soon as we do that, as soon as we take women out of the story, we lose so much, because there are no great men without a woman who birthed them. And fed them and diapered them, women who loved them, women who were their friends and inspired them and who they shared confidence with. There are no lawyers without clients, and Lincoln had lots of female clients. There are no leaders without people willing to follow, and Lincoln had a whole contingent of those as well. Half of the country were women, and Lincoln saw them as part of his constituency, and they informed his thinking. And as soon as we take women out of the equation, we lose a great deal in the telling of the story. Not a problem with Lincoln biography. It's a problem with the biography of great male figures, that the women fall away, and a lot of the humanity of the story is lost.
That's author Stacy Lynn. SIU Press is releasing her book, Loving Lincoln, A Personal History of the Women Who Shaped Lincoln's Life and Legacy. She spoke with Maureen McKinney. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. With hate crimes rising across Illinois over the last 5 years, lawmakers are considering a bill to allow people to sue if they receive threatening flyers on private property due to protected identity characteristics. Charlie Schlinker has more.
Bloomington Normal had an incident with anti-Semitic flyers last year. Democratic State Representative Sharon Chung jumped on the bill after that.
We have had our community sort of targeted by these sort of like white supremacist groups. You know, for me, when this happened in Bloomington, it was really shocking.
The measure has some support, though opponents say the language is vague and could be weaponized to hurt groups such as student protesters and activists. Worker rights attorney Chris Williams says it could be used to target pro-Palestinian protesters with civil litigation, leaving them with difficult choices.
People don't have the money to defend themselves, and if richer interests have money to bring those kind of actions and can afford a lawyer, there's nothing you can do but either settle, default, or pay lots of money to defend yourself.
Williams says fighting a lawsuit is time-consuming and expensive, and most college student protesters wouldn't have the money to see it through. Representative Chung says she hadn't heard much of the opposition until recently and can understand those concerns.
But at the same time, again, this is sort of about people who are putting flyers, hateful speech in that way that are specifically intended to sort of really strike fear in communities.
The Anti-Defamation League of the Midwest denies the criticism. Spokesperson Rebecca Weininger says her organization pushed the bill to combat hate crime.
By empowering the victims of this behavior to bring civil suits against the perpetrators of this behavior, we are ensuring, we are enabling victims to recover damages that they have suffered as a result of being threatened on their private property.
The Anti-Defamation League recently released a report that says hate crime has risen throughout the state. The league formed to combat anti-Semitism has faced controversy in and outside the organization. Some members conflate criticism of Israel and anti-Semitism. Weininger says the bill does not target critics of Israel.
Throwing flyers around that call for the elimination of the state of Israel, that is also not violative of this legislation. So we care very much that this legislation is very narrowly tailored to respond only to the threats of physical violence against the owners of private property.
Tension over the bill comes as the federal government has revoked student visas across the country for actions relating to protesting. The government revoked visas for a small number of Illinois State University students a few weeks ago, though there is no confirmation that action connects to protests. Attorney Chris Williams worries the bill could force disclosure of private student information during the discovery stage of litigation.
Right? I have a colorable claim. I can argue I should be entitled to look at their cell phone text messages to get at their intent, to get at what they were thinking, to get at whether they intended that to be malicious or not. I have the right to do that in civil litigation.
The Anti-Defamation League's Rebecca Weininger argues the discovery process protects against that. Weininger says it is a strict and multi-step process covering only information that clearly contributes to a conclusion in the case.
So if you file a lawsuit merely to try to get to discovery, you're wasting your time because the scrutiny through which a piece of litigation has to go before it gets past a motion to dismiss is very serious.
The American Civil Liberties Union of the Midwest is neutral on the bill. Spokesperson Ed Yonka says the ACLU does share concerns about the execution of the bill in a tense political climate.
This federal administration and this White House is weaponizing speech, is labeling some speech as anti-Semitic or is labeling people as terrorists simply because they don't agree with them. I think we're concerned about the climate in which this ordinance would be likely to be enforced.
The lawmaker who originally filed the bill has handed responsibility for it to Democratic Representative Dave Vella of Rockford. Vella is a lawyer who plans to clarify the language of the bill and to lay out consequences for weaponizing it.
So what we're talking about doing is twofold. One is called a slap motion, which allows a falsely accused person to go into court, the case dismissed right away, and have them get some kind of monetary value from the false accuser. So if somebody tries to use our bill in a way it's not meant to, that they get penalized, because we don't want anybody to stop free speech.
Vella says the amendment process will involve advocates from all groups, such as pro-Palestinian activists. Vella says he's not certain whether the bill will move forward this session.
We've got a meeting with groups in the next couple days trying to figure out whether that's even possible. And if it is, then yeah, an extension would be a good idea. If not, we'll wait. We'll work it over the summer.
The bill is currently in the Rules Committee, where bills usually go to die. Some lawmakers believe it could come back in the form of a shell bill. At the very least, Vella says it could be brought back next year with updated language. With reporting from State Capitol reporter Cesar Toscano, I'm Charlie Schlenker.
The Soybean Innovation Lab at the University of Illinois has hired back some of its laid-off staff because of a private donation. The lab was set to close after the Trump administration canceled its funding. Peter Goldsmith is the lab director. He says the million-dollar grant will allow them to continue work for a year on adapting soybean farming and processing in the East African nation of Malawi.
So all the various features are in miniature, and that was intentional. We thought that would be helpful to maximize the potential that we would be able to find additional funding in the future.
The anonymous gift was sent through the Founders Pledge. The London-based nonprofit administers charitable giving by wealthy entrepreneurs. Illinois universities are quietly withdrawing from a fellowship aimed at diversifying the state's college teaching force under pressure from the Trump administration. The U.S. Department of Justice has threatened to sue campuses that take part in the Diversifying Higher Education Faculty in Illinois, or DEI, fellowship. Caught in the middle are students who've relied on the program. Lisa Curian-Phillip has more.
Jennifer Torres isn't surprised the Trump administration came after the program. It's called the Diversifying Higher Education Faculty in Illinois Fellowship. So it was an easy target for the president's escalating attacks on efforts to address systemic racism in America.
Anything that has these words, they're coming for us. Like, we kind of feel it.
Torres has been a recipient of the fellowship for 4 years now. She's pursuing her PhD at the University of Illinois Chicago. What did surprise her is how quickly her university leaders gave in to federal pressure.
Most of us were disappointed because at the very least we were expecting for them to put up a little bit of a fight, as opposed to just saying, like, they told us to cut it, so we cut it.
In an email to current fellows, a dean at UIC said the Justice Department ordered the university to do so. The DOJ said the diversity fellowship is unconstitutional, saying it discriminates on the basis of race. They threatened schools across Illinois with legal action if they didn't ditch it. It's a scary threat. But students like Amina McBride-Retsevic, a recent fellow, say they want their universities to stand up to Trump and protect programs like this one.
If you are true to the values that you claim, the values that are espoused on the university website of, you know, education and equity and academic freedom and all of these things, then you'll take the momentary or the short-term pain that may come from pushing back on these unfair and unjust perspectives to support all of your students in what they need to be successful.
A UIC spokesperson says the Illinois Board of Higher Education made the decision to end the fellowship, but a representative of the state board disputes that. He says the state board and lawmakers agreed only to evaluate the program, which is enshrined in state law. The fellowship provides a monthly stipend and mentorship to students from underrepresented groups to help them pursue advanced degrees at institutions all across the state. In exchange, they agree to teach at colleges in Illinois when they graduate. The idea is to make professors and staff more representative of students. Here's McBride-Retsevic again, who is hoping to finish her PhD this June and start teaching.
For me, as a Black Muslim woman, I want to be able to give other students who look like me and who have my lived experiences an opportunity to connect with somebody and to be mentored by somebody who understands where they're coming from and the experiences that they've gone through to be able to get to where they are.
She and Torres say the diversity fellowship helped them pay their rent and groceries and navigate a world that was not set up for students like them. students whose communities have historically been shut out of higher education. Torres worries that without the fellowship, graduate degrees will be even less accessible to Black and Brown students like her.
All that these resources were trying to do was make way for all of the people who were excluded so that it could, academia can look somewhat like how it ideally should have looked if we weren't living in like a racist, patriarchal place.
There are currently 115 students across the state on the fellowship this year. It's unclear how many will be able to receive it next year. Lisa, Corey, and Philip, WBEZ News.
The Federal Library Department has put almost all of its staff on leave. What does that mean for your town's library, especially if you live in a small community or a rural area? Emily Hayes reports.
It's quite possible that you've never heard of the Institute of Museum and Library Services. The IMLS gives libraries grants to help them keep up with changing times.
This is a very small agency that has impacts on almost every community in the whole of the United States and territories.
That's Kate McDowell. She's an IMLS grant recipient and associate professor at the School of Information Sciences at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.
What the IMLS funds is not just the subsistence of libraries, although that's there too. It's their future.
But the future of that funding is in doubt. In March, President Trump issued an executive order that put almost all of the IMLS staff on administrative leave. He claimed the move would reduce unnecessary bureaucracy. On average, federal funding made up less than 2% of rural library operating budgets in Illinois in 2019, and less than 0.5% of urban library budgets. The grants might be small, but McDowell says they will impact the poorest patrons first.
Those extra hours to get that little bit of expertise and how to make sure you can help them fill out the forms right, or just to have somebody cover the desk while you go to a computer with a person, that's what gets axed in moments like this.
So how is this playing out in rural Illinois? The village of Greenup is about 44 miles southwest of Terre Haute, Indiana, along I-70. About 1,300 people live here.
You're welcome to take a look around, or yeah. I can walk you through or whatever.
That's Vicki Pierce. She calls herself just the circulation clerk at the Greenup Township Public Library. The library is basically one main room.
We've divided our children's, our adults, but our movies are here.
She says few teenagers prefer the library to social media, but they keep a streamlined, up-to-date selection for any who do come through. Pierce has worked here for 8 years after retiring as an English teacher. She's one of three part-time employees.
And then we have classics here that are typically the ones that everybody groans about having to read, you know, like Great Expectations and such like that.
There are a few computers in the adult section and a partially completed puzzle on a table in the back meeting room.
We're a small town library, so really small budget. And honestly, I'm not sure how we manage to stay open.
According to the library's new director, Marlena Harper, the library isn't expecting any federal money this year. The grants vary year to year. In 2019, for example, the federal government covered around 5% of the operating costs. That's a larger share than most libraries in the state. The federal support for Greenup jumped to about 19% in 2022 during the pandemic. The idea of taking more money away from other libraries makes Pierce feel sick, and she's not alone. Deb Culp is still simmering after hearing about the Trump administration pulling back money that was already granted to Decatur schools.
I don't know how to speak other than swearing when it comes to that certain idiot that's in the White House.
She thinks it should be illegal to claw back money that's already being spent.
They had things earmarked for that money, you know, and you just don't do that to people.
But the American Library Association says it's already starting to happen across the country to libraries and museums receiving IMLS grants. Shauna Ridgely is less certain about what the Trump administration should or should not do. She's looking through boxes of books the library is selling as part of its biannual sale.
It does scare me that we get rid of third spaces, free third spaces, that we get rid of spaces where people who can't afford things, you know, now you're cutting them out of the equation.
Both Ridgely and her mother were librarians at one time. Her mother raised her alone and instilled a love of reading.
As a parent, you can go in and you can say yes. So if the kid wants to have 10 books to take home, you can say yes, and it's not going to cost you anything.
Still, she sees the value in cutting government spending.
I'm a very budget-oriented person, so the fact that we are trillions of dollars in debt makes me ill.
After a busy Friday afternoon, the phone rings.
Greenup Library, this is Vicki. Yes. Do you want me to check it out and bring it by?
Pierce tells me she wants people to use the library, so she's happy to go out of her way, like bringing a book to a patron if that's what it takes.
You have a section of your population,
that is trying to keep current, trying to stay educated, but they're not being supported. And when you take that away, you're taking away the freedom.
Despite the cuts from Washington, the services provided by the Greenup Library are staying the same for now. 21 state attorneys general are suing the Trump administration to stop it from dismantling the Institute of Museum and Library Services. Congress has funded the department through September. I'm Emily Hayes with Illinois Public Media.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being along with us. Join us next week. We'll return once again with reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.